Why would we be interested in it? Yeah.
Because if we want to understand the universe fully, we have to understand every part of it from others.
Okay, good, good, good. We can understand all parts, the large and small, and quantum applies to the small. So there's this general sense that we would like to understand everything. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah, so there's things like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which tell us that what's going on at really super ultra-microscopic scales is different from what's going on in our day-to-day experience. So it tells us something interesting about the universe, and perhaps something useful, right? If we can understand how nature is working at the level of atoms, and now that we have the technology to actually work at the level of atoms, to construct things at that level, we're going to be working in that regime. And if we understand how nature works at a level, we can build cool things like quantum computers, quantum cryptography, all that kind of stuff. Okay, but there's a bigger reason, at least in my mind, sort of why it's really important, and that is that it tells us how it is possible for atoms to exist in our universe. As I mentioned the other day, the basic fact is that. And we'll be talking about this, but the basic fact is that if you take, say, an electron and a proton, which are the ingredients of a hydrogen atom, and you put them together, if the world worked according to how Maxwell thought it worked and how Maxwell and Newton, that atom simply would disintegrate. That atom is unstable. Okay, so quantum ideas allowed us to understand how it is, you know, the tricks that nature has up her sleeve to make atoms possible in our universe. And like, you know, atoms are everywhere, right? Rocks, trees, and people can't exist without quantum mechanics, without the quantum nature of the universe. Okay, so it's an important subject, and it's a really cool subject. So we're going to be talking a little bit about that starting today. So how many of you have done the Stern-Gerlach apparatus, Stern-Gerlach experiment? Any of you looked at that? Stern-Gerlach, okay. How many of you have looked at single slit, double slit? Okay. Everybody. Okay. So we're going to go very quickly then over the single slit, double slit. I'll just remind you about that, and what that's going to lead us to is a very, very deep result, which we're then going to apply in various situations to get an understanding of the quantum nature of the universe. Okay. So let's start with the single slit experiment. Okay, so what we've got is a source of particles, a source that is emitting particles. Okay, and these particles can be anything. They can be electrons, they can be protons, they can be even entire atoms. Okay, as long as they're small particles. Okay, and just for definiteness, we'll typically say electrons. But they could also be photons and so on and so forth. So this source is emitting these electrons, and the way it does it is you could take a piece of metal and heat it very hot, and then the electrons will boil off, and then you will have free electrons, and you can accelerate them with an electric field up to some velocity or whatever, and then you get this stream of electrons coming out, basically in random directions, like this. So they're just spraying out like that. Okay, and we will suppose that we've selected our electric field or whatever, however this device works, we don't really care. But at the end of the day, what we care about is that each particle that's coming off here has a definite amount of momentum, a definite amount of oomph of motion. So a momentum P. And if we're in non-relativistic case, which we'll just assume here, the momentum is the same thing as the mass of the particle times its speed. Okay, so we've got these particles spraying out here, and then we put up a barrier. Let me just put a center line here. Okay, so we put up a barrier with a slit like that in it, and we have a screen over here. Okay, and this screen is lined with a whole bunch of detectors, particle detectors. so we can detect wherever particles hit that screen. So we start with particles here. They come flying out here. And at the end of the day, we're going to get particles hitting this screen. Okay, and what goes on in between is what's interesting. All right, so let's suppose that these particles were just classical, and we're not thinking anything unusual is going on. Okay, so we have this stream of particles coming out like this. Say this particle over here ends up, hits that barrier and bounces off. Okay, this guy over here, you know, hits the barrier and bounces back like this. But of course, some of these particles will pass through this slit and they'll end up on this screen. How could I figure out the region on this screen? What's your guess about the region on this screen where these particles will hit? Line of sight? Size of the slit? Yeah. So suppose that this is essentially a point source back here. And so then one would expect that the particles would hit in this region over here. So as we, you know, we turn on this source and these electrons or particles are coming through, and say maybe one particle hits there, another particle hits there, the third one hits there, and so on. So it's going to be hitting all inside this region over here. But it's not going to be hitting the screen out here. Okay, so that's the shadow region. Just like the shadow. Okay, so that's very good. And so we would describe, so let's say this is x here, and this is x equals 0. We would describe the pattern of hits to be something like this. So there's lots of hits over here, and basically no hits here. And so if we were to draw a curve, which is a curve representing the pattern of the hits, that curve would look something like this. So we'll call this guy P, pattern of the hits as a function of x. Okay, so that's very easy. And in fact, this is exactly what happens. Okay, provided that the momentum of the particles is very large. Okay, so if these are very, very fast moving particles coming through here, basically, they're only going to hit the screen in this in this line of sight region over here, and none of them will enter that shadow region. So this is for large P. Okay, but then we notice something very peculiar starts to happen. If we take this this source and we turn down the electric field, we turn down the velocity of the particles, we turn down the momentum of the particles, then we start noticing that, yeah, okay, so sure, we still have particles hitting in here, but occasionally we'll have particles hitting in the shadow region. Maybe one here, then the next one there, the next one here. And so occasionally we'll get particles hitting in this shadow region. And so this nice sharp pattern here starts to spread out. Okay, so it might look something like this. Okay, so we'd get this kind of a pattern for smaller. Okay, and if we really turn down the momentum really, really low, okay, the particles are moving very, very slowly, then we would find that the particles can hit way out here. Okay, so they'll hit all over the screen. Okay, and the probability pattern will get very, very spread out, something more like that. Okay, so that's very small momentum. Okay, so there's a couple of things that I'd like to mention about this result, because this is actually extremely odd, very, very bizarre. Okay, so two key observations from this experiment is that there is a certain sense of randomness in these results here. Okay, so it turns out that no matter what we do with, no matter how we try to control the electrons with the source, by building a more accurate source, trying to beam the particles on a narrower beam, et cetera, at the end of the day, when you make this when you make this, either make the slit narrower or reduce the momentum, basically the particles start to spread out on over a wider area, and we have no way of predicting in advance where any given particle is going to hit the screen. So we can certainly tell when this source emits a particle, because maybe it's charged or whatever, and we notice the electric charge goes down or whatever. So we know that the source has emitted a particle, but we have no idea. We have no way to predict in advance where it's going to hit. There seems to be a truly random nature to how the particles are getting from the source to the screen. Okay, and so that pattern there, that pattern of hits that we called P of X, we would actually interpret that as a probability pattern. So P of X is a probability pattern. Okay, so when we look at something like this, probability pattern looks something like that. What we mean by that is, yep.
Electron interact with atoms
in the wall. So what we're imagining is, so this screen here, so sure it's composed of atoms, but what we're doing is, and those electrons can interact with those atoms, but we want to keep track of where the electrons actually hit. So what we would do is line this screen with a whole bunch of detectors, very small detectors. Those detectors can be as small as atoms. For example, we can have the electron hit some phosphorescent surface, like the surface of it, like the inside surface of a television screen. So the electron hits a cathode ray tube. The electron hits the surface, interacts with the atom, and then causes one of the electrons, causes the atom to enter an excited state, and then the atom drops down and emits a photon. So we can say, yes, there's a flash of light at that point on the screen. So yes, we detected a particle there.
Yes, but there are still some charge move the particle, right? I mean that if an atom moves and here is an electron, and it can,
Oh, I see. So here's one electron comes in like this, and then it charges the screen negatively here. So the next electron comes in and says, oh, that's a negative charge, I'm going to repel from it.
Yes, it could maybe go that way
and that could affect the randomness. Yeah, okay, so that's a good point. So what we want to do is we want to arrange our experiments, design our experiments so that we don't have that kind of stuff happening. And one way to do that is this source here, this source, say, emits charged particles. And when the electric charge goes down there, we increase the electric charge. And when the electric charge hits the screen here, we this is connected to ground. And so the electron just makes it eventually to ground. Okay, and another way to help with this is, because there might be some time involved in it, making its way to ground and so on. So what we do is we could just fire one electron at a time. One electron, and then something happens, there's a flash on the screen somewhere, or a detector fires or something, and then we wait an hour. Neutralizing, touch this thing, neutralize it, all that kind of stuff, and put it back to its original state, and then fire another electron. And we could do that, and that way we would eliminate all such problems. So there are lots of, actually doing an experiment like this is tricky. Lots of technical considerations, lots of experimental prowess is required to make this thing, work in an idealized fashion. But we're just imagining in an idealized situation, this is what would happen if we could do this experiment in an ideal way. And I'll show you a movie of an experiment that's actually been done like this. So this probability pattern, what it means is something like this. Suppose that our detectors are of a certain finite width. I mean, they're very, very small. And suppose we ask, what is the probability that this detector will go off? Okay, well, then what we do is we just take a little rectangle, that's the width of that detector, bring it up to the curve, and we determine the area of that little rectangle. Okay, so if I compare, say, the probability of this detector detecting an electron versus this detector here, because so the rectangles are the same width, but because the height of the curve is bigger here than here, there's a greater probability that the electron will hit that detector. Okay, so that's just the nature of a probability curve. And one thing to notice is that the probability of an electron hitting any individual spot, a perfect point, is of course zero, because the width of the rectangle is zero. So when we're talking about probability curves, we're always talking about, you know, what is the probability that the electron will hit the screen within some finite width. And of course, as you make that width smaller, that probability goes to zero. Okay. But so you're really interested in relative probabilities. It's more likely to hit the screen around here where the curve is large, and less likely to hit around here where the curve is smaller. Okay, so that's just the nature of a probability curve, probability pattern, and that's what we seem to have to begin to introduce here. And we'll say a lot more about that as we go along. This is just the first sort of hint that such a thing will be necessary. Okay, so the second main thing that we learn about this experiment is this weird spreading of the particles. Okay, so when the momentum is large, then the particles do what we would expect with just, say, baseballs. Okay, so they just hit along the line of sight, and none of them enter the shadow region. But as we start cranking down the momentum, turning down the velocity, we find that these particles spread out, and they hit the screen outside of, or in the shadow region. Okay, so this is spreading, is the second weird thing. Okay, so our probability pattern spreads out as our momentum is reduced. And the real question is, I mean, this is the really mysterious thing. I mean, so why? How could that possibly happen? I mean, if we're thinking in terms of Newtonian physics, here's our source here, and you know, I can sure understand particle trajectories like this, but I can't understand how a particle could possibly make it over there. I mean, what is it doing? How could it possibly bend? I mean, there are no forces acting. It's not as if we have an electric field here causing the particle to bend its trajectory here. Okay, how does it actually make it there? So that is our first sort of clue that maybe something is going wrong with say F equals ma. Maybe we can't use F equals ma to describe the trajectories of these particles. I mean, at the end of the day, we'll see that we can use F equals ma, but only in a sort of average sense. Okay, but in any detailed sense, looking at any individual particle getting from here to here, F equals ma isn't going to help us. Okay, so something is shifting here in our understanding of the universe. All right. So are there any questions on this? Can anyone think of a way in which a particle's trajectory could bend here? A really simple, obvious way, yeah. Waves? If they're waves, yeah. But are they waves? Well, they do display a wave-like nature, so we'll see that. Yeah, we can talk about this in terms of waves. But the odd thing is that this is a particle. It starts as a particle and it ends as a particle. Does it turn into a wave somehow between here and here? Like what is it? So what is actually going on? I mean, it turns out that we will be able to use wave ideas to describe the behavior of particles. But waves and particles are like two different things, totally different things. So yeah, we're going to be introducing waves and talking about particle behavior, but just in terms of particles themselves, just classical Newtonian particles. Can anyone think of how a particle could go from here to there? Bounce off, so ricochet off of this slit. So that's a good thing. I want to just address that right now here. So here's this particle. If the particle is big like this and it comes like this, then sure, it can bounce off of that edge and go like that. But I want you to think about this carefully. If we take this, we're going to consider two idealizations. One is we're going to make our particle very, very small. Okay, so it's just going to be a little point particle like that. And the other is we're going to make the barrier very, very thin. Okay, so this is a super ultra knife edge slit, and the particles are really just point particles like that. Okay, so if we compare this situation, suppose we have, you know, this kind of big kind of barrier and big kind of balls coming through like this, then you can see, okay, well, out of these three balls, this one will go straight through, whereas this one here is going to ricochet off like this, and this one's going to ricochet off like this. Okay, so if the balls are big enough that are going through, then you're going to get a significant fraction of them ricocheting off the edges. And that might account for this particles hitting outside of the shadow region. But if we reduce the size of the particles to super, super tiny, so there are 3 million particles across this width here, okay, and they're all going this way here. 2,999,000, are gonna just go straight through, and only those edge ones are gonna ricochet off. So the fact of the matter is, by considering smaller and smaller particles and thinner and more and more knife edge slits, you can reduce that effect as small as you like. Okay, and in principle, you can do that, and makes no difference to the experiment, no matter how small or whatever you make the particles. Basically, you can eliminate that effect. That is not what's going on. Something different is going on. Is that clear? Okay. So let's look at the double slit experiment now. Okay, so now it's the same game here. We have a source of particles here, which is emitting particles, for example, electrons, with some definite momentum p. And now instead of one slit, we have two. And our screen there is lined with a whole bunch of detectors and so on and so forth. And we will call this slit number one, and this one slit number two. Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to imagine that P is very, very small. So we notice when the momentum is large, we get a very sharp probability pattern. When the momentum is small, we get a very spread out probability pattern. So we're going to imagine that P is small to begin with in this double slit experiment, which means that if we say close this slit off here, so we have only one slit open, then what we're going to get here is a very wide pattern of hits. Okay, so here is the line of sight. Okay, so for very large momentum, we get a pattern like this, but we've cranked down the momentum so that we get a very wide pattern of hits. Something like that. Okay, and similarly, if we were to just close that slit and open that slit, our line of sight pattern is like that, and we get some, but we've turned down momentum, so we get something very wide. Okay, so something that looks like this. Okay, so here's the thing. Suppose that we pick a point on the screen, say this point over here, some distance d, away from the center line there. And what we notice is this. Suppose that we have slit number two closed and slit number one open, and we run this experiment for some amount of time. And so just law of probability and so on and so forth, we're going to get a certain number of particles entering the detector at the location of D here. Okay, so the probability pattern that controls that one is this guy over here. So this is P1 of X here. And we're gonna integrate under here. We're gonna determine the area of this guy. We're gonna determine that, this one here. A certain number of particles will hit there. And let's suppose that it's, say, 10 particles. So in a given amount of time, with just slit number one open, 10 particles would enter the detector at location D. Okay, and then we reverse the situation. Okay, so we open slit number two and close slit number one. Now we just have one slit open. We're back to the single slit case. And instead of just going along this line of sight, we have the particles spread out quite a ways. Most of the particles will be hitting around here on the screen, but occasionally some of them will hit up here. okay, fewer, okay? So maybe this is like, say, something like 7. So in the same amount of time, maybe 7 particles hit, okay? And now, if we open both slits simultaneously, how many particles do you think in the same amount of time are going to enter this detector here? 17? Right, so we just add up 17. So take this plus this, and we would get this. So basically, we would think, okay, let's just add these two curves. So what we would expect is a probability pattern. So let's call this guy P2. And so what we would expect is a probability pattern that is just the sum of the two. Okay, just like that. Okay, which makes total sense, right? I mean, with just slit one open like this, particles can make their way through this slit over here and hit the detector there, and on average, maybe 10 of them will happen in, say, in an hour. Okay, and then if we reverse that, particles could also come this way, and maybe fewer of them, maybe 7. Certainly, if we open both slits, particles can come this way and hit the detector, or come that way and hit the detector, and so on average, it would add up. So the probability patterns would just add up. Okay, so, and are we okay with that? Does that make sense? Okay, so when we actually do the experiment, we find something totally different, as you know. So what we find is this. So I'll just draw, I'll just take this screen and redraw it over here and show what we actually see. So what we actually see is something like this. A probability pattern that looks like that. Okay, so in particular, what's really, really bizarre, I've just chosen this particular point on the screen here. Here's the detector located at D. And what we notice is that we run the experiment for an hour, and no particles hit this point D, okay, with both slits open. Okay, this is extremely bizarre, because we know that with just slit number one open, we know for sure that particles hit this point. In fact, we know 10 will hit that point in that hour. If we have just slit number two open, we also know that particles can make it to that point D, hit that point D, in fact, about 7 in that hour. Okay, so with one or the other slit open, particles can hit this point on the screen. And yet, for some reason, when we open both slits, no particles hit the screen. Okay, this is extremely bizarre. This is one of the central mysteries of the quantum nature of the universe that people in this building are still grappling with. Okay, so this was discovered, you know, in the early 20th century. We still have no way of really understanding what is actually going on here. Okay, so we might say, oh yes, well, light involves waves, blah 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 blah. But the idea of waves and particles, how they come together, is still deeply mysterious. Okay, what is actually happening is really strange. Okay, so, yeah. So we can do this. So the question is, are we doing this experiment with lots of electrons coming through, or just one electron or whatever? Or we can do it either way. So we can do it with lots of electrons coming through at any given time, okay? And well, provided there's not so many electrons that the electrons start to repel each other and so on. But we can do it with lots of electrons, or we can even turn the intensity of the electron beam really, really low, so there's one electron every hour. Okay, so one electron comes through, it hits somewhere on the screen, maybe it hits over there, and then we wait an hour, and then we send another electron through, and maybe the next one goes over there, hit another, you know, wait another hour, and so on, and we will get a pattern of hits. And that pattern of hits will slowly build up. We'll find that, you know, after, you know, 3 weeks, we have lots of them have tended to hit around here, lots of them have tended to hit around here, and around here, but very few have tended to hit around here. Okay, so there's no way that it is, you know, one electron kind of interacting with another electron. This is totally one single individual electron going through. One single electron going through behaves in such a way that when a whole bunch of them go through after a long time, the total pattern that builds up is something like that. Yes. So if you change, so how do you think it will affect it? If the momentum gets larger, how do you think the pattern will be affected? Sorry? Yeah, that's right. So these, the maxima, so this is a region of maximum, this is a region of maximum. The distance from the central maximum here to the next maximum will decrease. So as we crank up the momentum, this pattern will become tighter, more like that. And if we reduce the momentum, the pattern will become looser. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, the bare fact is that there are points on the screen that the electrons can hit when just one or the other slit are open, but can't hit when both slits are open. How is that possible? How is it possible that a single electron in the apparatus at any given time, so the electron leaves here, it leaves as a particle, and it gets detected as a particle somewhere along the line. Suppose it takes this slit to get from here to there. Well, if it takes this slit to get from here to there, how could it even know that this slit is open or closed? It's nowhere near this slit. This slit can be very far away from this slit. The two-slit separation can be large. So if it takes just one, say, if it goes through this slit, how could it even know that this one is open or closed? That's just really freaky. So does it somehow go through both slits? Like, how could it know about the other slit unless it's there? It's just a particle. How could it mysteriously know about this thing? Okay, so what I want to do is I just want to show you an experiment which actually does this double slit. Okay, so as I said, there are lots of technical difficulties with doing an experiment like this, and it was. It wasn't until the last, couple of decades where this double slit experiment was actually done. So, in exactly this way. I mean, since the early 1900s, we've known that if we actually did an experiment of this type, this would be the result. But technology just wasn't there. But now it is. Technology is there where we can actually do the experiment, an experiment very much like this. So, are there any questions? Yeah. So, if it's a really large momentum with the two slits, yeah, then two things will happen. Two effects. So first of all, we're assuming that that the momentum is small, and the reason for that is so that the pattern of hits through one screen is not very sharp. The pattern of hits through one individual screen is very spread out. Okay. Now, and similarly through the other split is very spread out. So there's a significant overlap, say at this point over here. You know, maybe that's 7, that's 10, or whatever. And then for that low momentum, we get this pattern over here. So then, as I said, if we turn up the momentum, what we find is that this pattern gets narrower and narrower. So the distance between these maxima gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But also at the same time, the pattern for an individual slit is going to become more like let me draw it over here. It's going to become more like this. It's going to become sharper here. Here. Okay. So at the end of the day, this thing is going to become very, very, you're going to get very, very narrow lines, but then it's going to start going down in the middle and going down at the ends there. So you'll end up with something more like this. So we're just assuming low momentum so that we get that spread and that overlap. Yeah, that's an important point. Yeah.
Because it changes when you change the momentum, are scientists thinking that maybe it's delayed before? Their explanation that I've heard is that it's acting as a water waves to two slits. So are they thinking that the electrons, if you shoot them faster, there's a time delay before it actually starts acting with itself to create the differences in the interference pattern?
Okay, so if the particle is going through very, very quickly, then there's not much time. So are you saying that we have the source here, and if the particle is going quickly, then it doesn't have a chance to be to sort of turn into a wave, so to speak?
And well, asking that, like, is it delayed? Like, are they thinking that it's delayed? Like, if it's going faster,
yeah.
Are they thinking maybe it has to, let's say, see the slip, and then it takes 2 nanoseconds before it starts acting quickly? Are they thinking that kind of idea, and faster it goes, it delays a lot, and it takes, it's gone through the distance before it actually starts acting the wave? That's why they think their pattern is different.
I don't think they're thinking along those lines. That it has to do with the fact about so basically, okay, when you think about a microscope is a device that allows you to see small things, but there's a diffraction limit with that microscope, so you can only see, so here's my little amoeba here inside my microscope. I can't see an amoeba if the basically, the objects that I can see with a microscope are objects that are of the order of the size of the wavelength of the light being used, or larger. Okay, so in order to see an object, if you can think about it this way. If I have, say, water waves coming this way, and I have, say, a post in the water like that, if the waves are very, very long wavelength compared to the size of that object, then those water waves are hardly going to see that object, and they will hardly be perturbed by that object. Whereas if the wavelength is very, very short, so it's a wave like this, and it hits this post, then that post is going to seriously disturb the water waves after that, and we're going to see a shadow region here. If the wavelength is long, it just kind of goes around like this, and a very small region of perturbation here. Okay, so the basic point is that the wavelength of the light or the particles or whatever that you're using determines the resolution that you can see. Okay, so when we're looking at slits like this, these slits have a certain size, have a certain separation, and the interference pattern depends essentially upon the wavelength, the size of the wavelength compared to the slit width here. Okay, so electrons sort of know, or photons or whatever has a wave-like nature, will know about the existence of structures that are of the size of the wavelength or larger, but they won't be able to see things that are much smaller than their wavelength.
Okay, so it's due to the change in the electrons' wavelength.
Yeah, due to the change in the electrons' wavelength relative to the size of the apparatus that it's going through. Yeah. Okay, so let's take a look at this. This is an actual double slit experiment done with electrons. It's done with an electron microscope, et cetera, et cetera. And let's just look at the pattern that comes out of it.
So this is done, Hitachi Corporation did this.
Now we are looking at the detector plane on the monitor. Bright spots appear here and there. These spots indicate individual electrons. Electrons are sent out only occasionally. Therefore, the chance of finding one electron in the microscope is very small, not to mention the chance of finding two. Since electrons are detected one by one as particles, we have to conclude that each electron must have passed through at random on either side of the bipolar, thus creating a uniform distribution without any interference when accumulated. Under such conditions, do electrons form a uniform distribution? But look, we begin to see some fringes in the perpendicular direction that looks like interference fringes. Since this experiment lasted for more than 30 minutes, I have sped the movie up. Interference fringes are now clearly visible.
There. So this is like totally remarkable. So the interference pattern that you're seeing on the screen there is this pattern here. seen from sort of a there's a side view here with our double slit here, and so these slits go into the board like this, and so we're going to get parallel lines on this screen when we view it from that direction. Okay, so that's what we're actually seeing. So I think that's just totally remarkable. All right, so any questions before we go on? Yeah.
Ooh, the triple slit experiment. Well, you can figure out what happens in the triple slit just by considering weights, and we're going to be talking about weights right now. So in the triple slit, I don't remember offhand what happens in the triple slit, but what you could do is just, you know, consider these as sources of weights and go along the screen here and determine what pattern you're going to get. I mean, for sure there's going to be a maximum at this central point here. Actually, that's not always true. It depends upon the slip length here. Could be a minimum or maximum. So it'll just be some more complicated pattern. But at the end of the day, you will get the same weird particle behavior. A particle behavior that seems to depend upon or seems to be described by wave behavior.
So if you have the first set of slits like this, and then you have a second set of slits, and then you move that around, would you be able to see like the waves getting covered and then showing up? Does it happen that quickly, or does it take a long time for it to like distribute throughout to have that pattern?
Okay, so suppose we had, say, a double slit here and say a triple slit over here. Something like this, or just whatever, just two screens with varying numbers of slits. And so now this guy over here is going to, the particles coming through here are going to spread out like this, and some of them will bounce off here, some will bounce off here, and then we'll get some spreading out here, and so on and so forth. And we'll get some pattern over here. So you're concerned about, like at the end of the day, what you can do is you can just put a point source of waves here, and then just calculate how the waves would pass through this apparatus, and that will tell you what the pattern will look like. And so are you saying that somehow if we suddenly insert a slit?
Well, if like you move the second screen so all the slits are covered, so it doesn't show on the third screen.
Okay.
Then and you move it back, is it gonna immediately make that pattern, or is it gonna take a while for it, that pattern to show up again on the third screen?
It depends on how quickly you move the screen. Okay, so you're thinking like this. Maybe a single slip here. So these slits are blocked. And so there's a certain sense in which that's going to block most of this pattern. And that's true. However, there still will be some pattern because the particles are coming through here. They're spreading out here. And some of them spread out to actually get into here. And then a small fraction. And so you're going to get sort of a low intensity pattern spraying out of this slit and a relatively low intensity pattern spraying out of this slit. And you'll get some pattern at the end of the day like this. And then if you move this, you slide this this barrier down so that now the slits line up with each other, then your pattern will get brighter and your pattern will change. And how fast it will happen will depend upon basically the velocity of the particles. So if you did this, you know, sort of instantly like this, pulled it down, then it would take essentially the time it takes for particles to go from here to here for the pattern to change. Okay. Right. Okay, so let's compare this particle behavior with waves. Well, actually, what I'd like to say here, just before going on, is so I'd like to just point out that the actual probability pattern is not just simply the sum.
you don't add probability patterns. Okay, we'll find that we add waves. We don't add probability patterns. Okay. Yep.
Error effects from the outside?
Yes.
So maybe electric fields from other places and so on? So the idea is just to try to control those errors as much as possible. And in an experiment like that, so I mean, it's hard to do. Like this experiment was very hard to do. But it was actually achieved to such a point where the errors, sources of errors, are small enough that the main phenomenon shows out clearly. And so the idea is if you reduce errors further, you will get it even more perfect. But it clearly is in that direction. The results are clearly in that direction. Okay. So let's compare this with waves. Let's look at the single slit and compare with a phenomenon called diffraction.
Okay, so we have a single slit like this, and we have a screen like this. So it's exactly the same setup. We have a source of something here, but instead of being a source of particles, we imagine that this is a source of waves, which go out like this. And then most of the wave hits the barrier and bounces back. You know, this wave front hits the barrier and bounces back. But some of the wave front appears in the slit and will produce and will get through. Okay, and so we'll get some waves hitting the screen. And the pattern of intensity of those waves hitting the screen will look something like this. If the wavelength is very, very small, so very, very tight waves like this, so for example, sunlight coming through a window. So the wavelength of light, of sunlight, compared to the size of the window, the wavelength is very small compared to the size of the window. So many, many wavelengths would fit across this slit. What sort of a pattern would I get here? Yeah, so I mean, so you all know from life experience that sun coming through the window leaves it makes a sharp pattern, a line of sight pattern. Okay, with no light going into the shadow region. So it looks like this. Okay, so that would be for small lambda. Okay, but for large wavelengths, okay, so a good example is sound waves. So I'm talking yak, 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 and the sound wave is, the wavelength is maybe this long and or even longer. And say if the door is open, people can hear me outside in the hall. How's that possible? Okay, it's possible because basically sound waves, if the wavelength is large compared to the size of the hole here, those sound waves can bend around corners. So that's one key feature of sound waves or any kind of waves. One key feature of waves is they can bend around corners. Okay, so the pattern might look something more like this. Okay, so this is large lambda. Does anyone know how this spreading happens? Does anyone remember Huygens' principle? Yeah. So each point on the wavefront, so we can think of our slit here like this, and here's this wavefront coming in like this, and so there's a wavefront inside the slit, and each point on the wavefront acts like a point source of waves. And so there's going to be little wavelets coming out like this, little wavelets coming out like this. Okay, and then they're going to go forward like that. But the point is a point source, I mean, a point source radiates widely like that. So this point source is radiating widely, and it actually radiates in that direction as well. Okay, and so the wave can appear to bend around the corner like that. Okay, so that's a very, very important property of waves. Okay, and one thing is that this pattern here, what is that pattern actually? Well, a wave is something which, if you think about water waves or whatever, or sound waves, there's positive and negative. For sound waves, positive and negative relative pressure, or water waves, it's positive and negative amplitude, and so on. But the actual intensity is just the square of the wave. So here's a wave, you know, which is going up and down like this. And what we do is we just square the magnitude of the wave to get the total, to get the intensity of the wave, the intensity of the light or the intensity of the sound. Okay, so what we actually do to get these patterns is this is, so this is the wave intensity, and then we square it. Okay, to get a positive number. I'm sorry, the wave amplitude, and we square it to get the positive number, the wave intensity. Okay, so here's the key thing. If we compare this situation with waves, here's a single slit experiment done with waves. We're going to compare with a single slit experiment done with particles, and we notice there's a huge similarity. Okay, so what we noticed is for the particle case, there were two extreme cases for particles. We had, this is for large momentum, and this curve here was for small. For waves, on the other hand, we had exactly the same kind of patterns, pair of patterns here. One is very focused and one is very spread out. We notice that this is for small wavelength. We've got the very focused pattern. But for large wavelength, we've got the very spread out pattern. Okay? And in the case of waves, that's called diffraction. All right, so we're led to two important ideas. One is that this probability pattern for particles, this P of X here, looks very much like the intensity of the waves, so the square of the amplitude of the waves, of the corresponding waves. Okay, so we're led to identify an amplitude, okay, so the wave intensity, we're led to identify a wave phenomenon, namely its intensity, with a particle phenomenon, namely its probability. Okay, so this is our first hint at some kind of relationship between particles and waves. And if you know a little bit about quantum mechanics and Schrodinger's equation and all that stuff, the idea is that this is Schrodinger's wave function, and when you square it, take its magnitude squared, you get something which tells you about the probability of finding a particle in a certain location. Okay, so we're starting to see that come out in this simple experiment. The second main thing that we learn from this, and this is more important, is we observe that this curve and this curve correspond to each other in the following cases. When so we get the tight pattern when it's large P here, whereas we get the tight pattern when it's small lambda. Here we get the spread out pattern when it's small P. Here we get the spread out pattern when it's large lambda. So there seems to be an inverse kind of relationship between P and lambda. So we're already talking about making some identification between wave properties, namely the intensity of the wave, and particle properties, namely the probability. And now we're going to try to make an identification between this property of waves, its wavelength, and this property of particles, namely its momentum. We're going to try to make an identification between P and lambda. But we know right away that it's not just that P is proportional to lambda. Because what we find is when P increases, that corresponds to lambda decreasing. So it's an inverse relationship. So it's actually P is proportional to 1 over lambda. Okay, so that's a very, very important observation. So small wavelength in the case of waves corresponds to or gives us the same kind of pattern as the pattern we get with large momentum, and vice versa. Okay. So what we do is we guess. Okay, so how many of you recognize that relationship? What's that called? Yeah. Okay. So except we don't know what this proportionality constant is yet. So let's try to figure that out. Okay, so all right, so to do that, to figure out what this proportionality constant is, let's look at the double slit experiment again. Okay, in the case of waves. So the phenomenon we're looking for here is called interference. Okay, so we're going to have a source, but instead of being a source of particles, it's a source of waves. So these waves come like this, and they hit this screen. And this slit acts like a source of waves. And it's very important that this source of waves experiences diffraction. So the waves coming through here are diffracted by that slit, and they spread out widely. It's very important. So the momentum has to be low enough, or sorry, the wavelength has to be long enough so that we get a wide spreading like this. And similarly for this slit, there's a large amount of diffraction. The wavelength is long enough, there's a large amount of diffraction. If there's not enough diffraction, then we're just basically going to get waves which just run along the line of sight here. And waves just run, which run along the line of sight, and we're going to get no overlap. So there's going to be no possibility of interference. Okay, so we have to turn the wavelength, we have to make the wavelength long enough so there's sufficient diffraction here from through both of those slits, so that there's a large region of overlap, significant overlap between those waves. And then, as you all know, we get wave interference happening. Okay, crests will add with crests and troughs with troughs, but crests and troughs will cancel out and so on. So at the end of the day, what we get is a pattern which looks like this. Okay, so if we take the wave amplitude and we square it to get the wave intensity, sine squared of x, we get a pattern which looks like that. Okay, so if we compare this interference pattern for the case of waves with the pattern we got for particles in the double slit case, which is back here, we notice that they are exactly the same. So this pattern over here has exactly the same kind of shape as this pattern over here. Now, if I were to decrease the wavelength, make the wavelength shorter distance between wave crests, what would happen to this pattern? It would shrink up. It would scrunch up like this. Okay, so if we have so this is for small wavelength. If I make the wavelength large, what's going to happen to this pattern? Just the opposite. It's going to stretch out, right? So I'm going to get pattern more like that. Okay, and so what we do here is we just say, okay, suppose that we've done this experiment with particles of a certain momentum. So P is equal to 6.2 in whatever units. Okay, and so we know the momentum of the particles in this case. And then we get some pattern over here on the screen. So we get some distance between the central maximum and the first minimum here, some distance d. And then what we do is we construct an exactly a similar apparatus with the same two slits and the same screen, the same distance between the barrier and the screen, et cetera, et cetera. The exact same setup, except we replace the source of particles with waves. Okay, maybe they're water waves, maybe they're light waves, whatever. And then we turn this thing on, and then we play with the wavelength. Okay, when the wavelength is really small, we're going to get a really tight pattern like this. Okay, so the distance from 0 to d is really, really small. Or if we make the wavelength long, this is large wavelength, then the distance from 0 to d is larger. And so we just adjust the wavelength. We play with the wavelength on our little dial here. And this curve will change between that and that. And then somewhere in between, we will get a curve which exactly matches this one. Okay, so this will then be sort of the just right case. Okay. And so when we do that, we can figure out the associated wavelength. So we can figure out the relationship between when p is 6.2 in whatever units we have, then we get a just right lambda. Lambda is, say, 4.7 in whatever units. So now we have a certain, for a certain value of p, we have a certain value of lambda. And what we're trying to do is we have this relationship p is, or lambda is proportional to 1 over p. So now we have lambda, which lambda is 4.7. That's supposed to be proportional to 1 over 6.2. Okay, so now we know what proportionality constant to stick in here to make this relationship work. Okay, and so we actually then end up with the final result here. And we can actually numerically get that that constant, the proportionality, which is called Planck's constant. Okay, here's numerical value, you know. So this is for when we match sine squared. With p of x, that allows us to determine that h. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, super. So the key point now is we're going to take this idea lambda equals h over p. This is called the de Broglie relationship. And this is our key. So what we've done is we've done some experiments, very very simple experiments in principle at least. And we've observed some surprising things, like the particle cannot hit the screen at certain locations when both slits are open, when in fact it can hit that location with just one or the other slit open. So weird things like that we've seen. And then just by a little bit of simple reasoning and comparing our results with particles with similar experiments with waves, we've found an important relationship between some kind of a wave property and some kind of a particle property. Okay, and so at the end of the day, what we want to do is we know, for example, that F equals ma doesn't work anymore. And so we can't use that as our mechanics for the particles. So the idea is, can we use this relationship that we've just sort of derived from the experiments, or sort of guessed from the experiments, to learn about the behavior of particles? The particles no longer obey F equals ma, but maybe they obey this equation. Maybe this is the equation which tells us about the behavior of particles in some weird way. Okay, and so what we're going to do is we're going to try to use this relationship exactly like that. We're going to try to use this formula. We're going to look at certain physical experiments, certain contexts in which we can place a particle, and then we're going to see, by applying this relationship, we're going to learn about the behavior of particles. Okay, and that behavior is this really weird quantum behavior. Okay, and it actually turns out that it's not, well, it certainly is fundamentally weird, but it's actually graspable. We can actually make sense. It makes a lot of sense at the end of the day. And so hopefully, by the end of these quantum lectures, quantum will make a lot more sense, okay? And it won't be like so totally mysterious. Okay, so why don't we take a quick break right now? That the wavelength, that the some kind of wave property, which is related to a particle property in this kind of inverse way. So the wavelength is, I mean, what we started with was a particle with some momentum p, but along the way we realized that to somehow reproduce these patterns that we see, wave ideas seem to be important, and so a wavelength got introduced. Okay, and so describing how particles behave seems to require wave ideas, which is just kind of weird in and of itself. So we have a formula which relates particle property, namely p, to a wave property, namely the wavelength. And so we deduced just from looking at the experiments that the relationship should be inverse. When the wavelength, when the momentum increases, that corresponds to an experiment with waves of lower or smaller wavelength. When the momentum decreases, particle momentum decreases, that corresponds to an experiment in which we've made the wavelength long. Okay, this inverse relationship. And then there's a simple proportionality constant here, which we can evaluate in any given experiment, and that's Planck's constant, 6.02. Okay, in appropriate units. So, for example, joule seconds. It's an appropriate unit. Okay. So what we want to do now is we want to take this relationship, which somehow is telling us something about the behavior of particles, and apply it to a very concrete situation. And in doing so, in struggling with trying to figure out what this thing is trying to tell us about how particles behave, we're going to learn a huge amount about the quantum nature of the universe, the nature of the universe at very, very small scales. So the example that we're going to look at is called the particle in a box. Okay, so by particle in box, I don't mean a three-dimensional box like this. So sort of in principle, we have that in mind, a particle bouncing around inside a box. So a particle that is confined in some way. But to simplify things, we're going to consider a one-dimensional box where the particle can just slide in one dimension. So you can imagine it physically like a little bead on a wire with a barrier at both ends. Okay, so our situation, more mathematically, you would look at it this way. This is along the x-axis here. We have a particle which can move along that x-axis between x equals 0 and x equals L. And that particle has some mass m, and it's doing something in this box, okay, and that's what we're going to try to figure out. I mean, certainly, and we also ignore things like friction. So this is a frictionless bead on here, and these are perfectly solid boundaries. So there's perfect reflection, and so on and so forth. I mean, certainly in a Newtonian universe, if I flick that particle like that, give it some energy, it's gonna fly along that wire, hit this barrier, bounce off, and then slide along the wire, bounce back, and it's just gonna bounce back and forth, right? If I give it only a little bit of energy, it's gonna move slowly back and forth, bounce, bounce, bounce. If I give it a lot of energy, it's gonna go bounce, 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 bounce. Okay, but that's it. That is the nature of a particle in a box, at least in Newton's universe. Okay, but now we recognize that the simple fact that, wow, a particle launched here can end outside, it can enter the shadow region, can end up over there. How does it do that? I mean, clearly, F equals ma in some way is breaking down, because there's no forces acting on this. It should be a straight line. But somehow, the usual laws, the usual ways that we think about particles and their behavior is going to break down. So as Param said on Sunday, this just like for example, maybe there's multiple paths or whatever. The very idea of a particle trajectory turns out to break down in quantum mechanics. The very idea that a particle can be moving on a definite trajectory at any instant of time, can have a definite position and a definite velocity on a definite trajectory, breaks down. And so this picture just disappears. So what's actually going on, what's actually going on with this particle inside this box is not at all obvious anymore. And so what we're going to try to do is try to make some sense of what might be going on, how that particle is behaving inside that box using that relationship there, like we might use F equals ma. Okay, but it's an unfamiliar relationship, and we're going to have to struggle a little bit to try to make sense of what it is trying to tell us about the nature of reality, of what's actually going on with this particle inside that box. Okay. So the only thing that we're going to assume about that particle in the box, remember, physics is all about reducing your assumptions as much as possible. Okay, so let's not assume that particles move on definite trajectories or anything like that. Let's just leave that open, because maybe they don't. Okay, so the only thing we're going to assume is something pretty basic, and that is that the particle has some energy E, a definite amount of energy. Okay, and the thing has a mass M. Okay, so that's it. It's the only thing we're going to assume, and then we're going to use this thing to try to see if it can tell us anything about what that particle is doing. Okay, so the first thing we know is that in Newtonian mechanics, first of all, the energy here, there's no potential energy. So we don't have this thing up on its side, and maybe there's gravitational potential energy or what have you. Okay, it's just horizontal like this, or in the absence of a gravitational field, there's only kinetic energy. There's no potential energy. So the total energy here is just kinetic energy. What's the expression for kinetic energy? 1/2 mv squared. What's the expression for kinetic energy in terms of momentum? T squared over 2m. It turns out that in certainly in quantum, momentum is much more useful, is a much more useful concept than velocity. Okay, so we almost never see velocity in quantum, we always see momentum. Okay, so we think in terms of momentum and energy. Right, so the energy, so what we're saying is that the particle has a definite amount of energy, which means that T squared over 2m is a definite number. Okay, and m is just the mass, so what that tells us is we can invert this equation and solve for P. So what is P? Plus or minus, right? Very important. So there are two solutions to that equation, plus or minus. Okay, so the plus corresponds to, so this is some number like 5. Okay, and it's saying plus or minus 5. Momentum is plus or minus 5. When it's plus 5, that means that that at least classically the particle is moving to the right with some momentum 5. When it's minus, it means it's bounced off the wall, now it's moving to the left. So there are two possibilities, obviously. Okay, so this is basically right and left. That's what the plus and minus correspond to. Okay, so now we know, so given the definite amount of energy, we know that it has a definite momentum, either plus or minus. But the magnitude of the momentum is known, it's just that square root. Okay, so now we look at that relationship and say, okay, now we have a particle with a definite magnitude of momentum right there. And that's just some numerical constant. So this equation, whatever it means, ultimately, is telling us that there's somehow to describe the behavior of that particle in the box, we're going to require a wave in some way. And what we know about that wave comes from this equation. It says that the wavelength lambda is h divided by that number p. Mm-hmm. So we know that somehow, whatever that particle is doing, it is somehow described in some way using a wave whose wavelength is h divided by p. And that formula, of course, means the magnitude of the momentum. So we just drop the plus or minus. So it's square root of 2me. Okay, so that's what we know. Okay, but how? Yeah. I don't know. That's what we're going to try to find out. So we're going to think about this wave. Yeah, I don't know what that wave is. I mean, so is it physically a wave? Is it a wave in the physical sense of an electromagnetic wave, which seems to have, you know, it has energy and momentum. All like electromagnetic waves carry energy and momentum, and so they're physical entities, just like a baseball. Okay? Is the wave that we're talking about here a physical entity, something that has energy and momentum and is real like a baseball, or is it simply a mathematical artifact, which helps us to describe the behavior of particles and doesn't have any physical reality? It's just part of the mathematics of describing the behavior of particles. So I don't know. We don't know at this point. Okay, so at this point in our discussion, all we know is there's a wave. And we'll think about what that wave might mean as we go along. Okay, so the first thing is, I should say something just at the outset, so that we're not confused by this later. It's telling us we have a definite amount of energy, and associated with that definite amount of energy is a wave with a definite wavelength lambda. We're only given one wavelength. There aren't other wavelengths involved. So I want to just show. Okay, so here's a wave with some wavelength. Okay, so it's moving along like this, and this is the wavelength, the distance between the crests. So it's moving maybe to the right or to the left or whatever. What I want to point out is that a traveling wave like this, a traveling wave that is infinitely long, an infinitely long wave train, both to the left and to the right, has a definite wavelength, lambda. If you were to imagine some kind of a wave packet, okay, so something which is, you know, like this, okay, or maybe it's like a pulse like this or whatever, which is moving along. As soon as you take an infinite wave train like this and maybe cut it off here and here, if you cut it off or you make it occupy a finite region of space like a wave packet, as soon as you do that, you have to introduce more wavelengths. Okay, so a wave like this, for example, is composed of many waves. It's composed of a wave whose wavelength is this, an infinite wave train whose wavelength is like this, plus an infinite wave train with a slightly different wavelength, and so on and so forth. So this is the subject of Fourier analysis. I don't want to actually get into this. I just want to say that for like any kind of a wave pulse, we might imagine that somehow that particle is associated with a little wave pulse which is bouncing back and forth. But I just want to point out that as soon as you introduce a pulse like that of some finite width, it requires more than one wave to be present. To make that wave, you have to add waves of many different wavelengths. Okay, is that at least intuitively clear at all? Yeah. Okay. So what we are told here is only one wavelength. That's it. Okay. Which means that what we're really talking about is a wave of infinite extent. Okay, an infinite wave train of like a pure frequency. Okay. As soon as you cut it off, and have a pulse or something, you have mixed frequencies. Okay, well, it's not telling us that. It's telling us it's a pure frequency, so it's an infinite wave train. Okay. Having said that, let's now think a little bit more. We've got this infinite wave train, and what we do know is that, well, it's not a finite, it's not an infinite region. Okay, so there's boundaries here and here. So let's just ignore the boundary here for a minute and imagine an infinite wave train coming in from the left and hitting that boundary there. So in this case, we'll say corresponding to the classical case of a particle with positive momentum, so a particle moving to the right, we would imagine that we've got maybe some kind of a wave moving to the right. Okay, and suppose we've got that wave and it's an infinite wave train. I mean, ultimately, that wave train is going to hit that barrier and it's going to bounce back. What are we going to get coming back? Okay, so another wave that's actually reversed like this. Okay, and so when we add a wave moving to the right and a wave moving to the left, what do we get? A standing wave. Okay, so ultimately, we're going to get a reflected wave. So here's the incident wave. Here's the reflected wave. And so if we have an incident wave, we because there's a barrier here, we automatically also have a reflected wave. And this is an infinitely long wave train. Okay, so the reflected wave is also infinitely long. So we've got this infinite train of waves coming in, moving to the right, and an infinitely long train of waves going to the left, and they're reflected at this point over here, and ultimately we get a standing wave in there, right? Okay, so okay, and similarly, corresponding to the case P equals minus 2ME. So at a classical level, that's a particle moving to the left. Okay, so what we've got is, ignoring the fact we've got a barrier there, corresponding to that classical case, we might imagine that we've got a wave whose wavelength is this, lambda equals that, which is traveling to the left. Okay, but then, of course, once it hits here, it bounces off, and we get a reflected wave, and the sum of the two, we've got a traveling wave this way, traveling wave that way, and we get a standing wave. Okay, so this is really, really important. So we are basically, as soon as we have a wave going one way or the other way, as soon as we have a wave going one way, we're automatically forced to have a wave going the other way. And it's basically infinitely long, and so we end up with just a simple standing wave. So we're forced. So let me just write it this way. So we're saying that the fact that there are boundaries is very, very important here. The fact that there are boundaries, places for the particle to reflect, means there are places for this infinite wave train to reflect. And because it's just infinitely long, we automatically have to have both the right and left moving waves, and hence superposition. And it's sum of two waves. Okay, so let me just sort of point out, I'm going to say a lot more about this as we go along, but at the classical level, we can have a particle with momentum plus this number, plus 5, or a particle with momentum minus 5. It's an either or. I mean, if we look into the, if we look inside that box at any instant of time, here's our little bead, it's either moving to the right or it's moving to the left. Okay, it's an either or situation. Whereas when we're talking, as soon as we introduce the concept of a wave, things change radically. Okay, that wave, because there's only one wavelength, it's an infinitely long wave train. Okay, because there are boundaries, though that infinitely long wave train is reflecting, we get a wave going to the right, a wave going to the left, we automatically get this standing wave. We have both waves present. We can't have only one wave or the other wave. We have to automatically have both. So at the classical level, we can have a momentum that's plus or momentum that's minus. As soon as we're into the quantum regime here, as soon as we start talking about waves, we have to have a right and a left traveling wave simultaneously. We can't have just one or the other. Both are present at the same time. That's very, very important. Okay? Let me actually show you just a quick applet here. Which describes a wave coming in from the left, hitting a boundary, and reflecting off, for those of you who are not totally familiar with that. So this is a great applet showing that reflection of waves and how you get a standing wave. So how many of you have studied like standing waves, reflecting waves, all that kind of stuff? And so everyone, okay, so you guys are all experts. Okay, well, I'll show it to you anyway, because I like it. Okay, so I know it's a little bit of a cheesy applet here, but here we go. Actually, let me pull it up a little bit. Okay, so here we go. Why? I want to see it again. Oh, I have to press start. Oh, we're gonna wait for the whole thing again. Okay, so here we go. I don't know how to make it go faster. Yeah, don't hit this. So this is a traveling wave to the right, a wave traveling to the right. And it's essentially an infinite wave train back here, and it hits here, and this is reflecting from a fixed end, okay. And so at the end of the day, we get this reflected wave, which is the red one is moving to the right, and the reflected blue one is moving to the left. Ooh, Okay, so then the red one is the wave traveling to the right, and the blue one is the wave traveling to the left. If we have a right traveling wave, okay, so remember the main point is here we've got boundaries. It's a bound particle, which means it's a bound wave. If you have a bound wave, if you've got a wave moving to the right, you automatically necessarily have a wave moving to the left. And when those add up, you get this standing wave over here, which is the black one. And what you'll notice about the standing wave, of course, is that it's standing, it's not moving. The red one is moving, the blue one is moving, but the standing wave is not. So the nodes and the antinodes are fixed in position. Okay, so that's it. Great. Okay. What happened to the eraser? Okay, so let's just draw a picture here. So we've got a wave moving to the right. The wave moving to the right is this guy. So classically, it corresponds to a particle with momentum plus p, and associated with that momentum is a wave of wavelength lambda. Okay, we've also got a wave moving to the left, which is classically associated with a particle moving to the left with momentum minus p, but the same magnitude of wavelength there, like that. Okay, so now the crucial thing is that, yeah. This one? Which letter? This one? Oh, that's a psi. That's a psi. Psi. So this represents, this is a symbol for the wave. So whenever I write psi with a subscript r, then that just means this wave moving to the right. And psi with a symbol l, it's just this wave moving to the left. Just a notation. Okay, so the crucial thing is as soon as this particle is bound, you have this bound wave, and wherever you have a psi right, you must have a psi left. Wherever you have a psi left, you must have a psi right. So both are present simultaneously, and then you get a total psi, which is right plus left, and which of course is a standing wave, which we saw. Okay, so the thing about a standing wave is that it has these nodes, this, and basically this wave can, we have two infinite traveling waves. Let's imagine that we start with two infinite traveling waves, then we will get this standing wave. And what the standing wave does is it alternates like this. So when this guy is going down, then this guy is going up and vice versa. And there is a time where they're all zero across, and just alternates back and forth like that. Okay, so that's the nature of a standing wave, and the wavelength of the standing wave is the same as the wavelength of our individual traveling waves. Okay, so we've got that. But now what we want is a bound particle. So we have to insert some, where are the boundaries of the box? Okay, well, clearly we can't put the boundaries of the box here, okay, because that would just kill this wave. So basically, the natural places for the boundary of the box are at these nodes. Okay, so the left boundary of the box is one of these nodes, let's say this one over here. Okay, and so everything else, the left of this, we don't care about. And the right boundary is also one of these nodes, so maybe this node over here, in which case we just ignore everything to the right of this. Okay, and so we can, in fact, have a standing wave inside a box between that boundary and that boundary with fixed endpoints. Okay, and we can, for example, on the guitar string, we can generate such things just by plucking it at the appropriate place. How many of you play guitar or some kind of a string instrument? And have you noticed that if you take the guitar string, here the guitar string is fixed at both ends like that, and if you touch your finger on the string at that point and pluck the string anywhere, then you will force a node to exist at that point, and it will then automatically force nodes to exist here and here as well. And so you'll actually generate a standing wave, which is a harmonic of the fundamental. So when you go, for example, right in the middle of the string and touch it there, then what you're doing is, so there's your string, and you touch your finger right in the middle, and then pluck the string, then you'll notice that you get a tone that's twice as high, okay, and that's the first harmonic here. So anyway, so inside this box, we presumably then have a standing wave, which has for sure a node at one end of the box, and for sure a node at the other end of the box, and some number of nodes in between. Maybe no nodes, maybe one node, maybe two nodes, and so on and so forth. So that's the obvious structure of what must be existing inside that box. What that wave means, we're gonna come to a little bit later. Okay, but so I want you to just realize that that essentially this standing wave must be thought of as two traveling waves, one traveling to the right, and one traveling to the left, that is present at the same time. And what's really freaky about that is, so in terms of standing waves, that's sort of obvious and simple. Sure, right traveling, left traveling, we get this standing wave. But in terms of the classical particle picture, it's like it's total nonsense. Because it's saying that we have a particle essentially moving with plus p and with minus p at the same time. Okay. For waves, that's not a problem to have a wave moving to the right and to the left at the same time, present at the same time. But for a particle to be both moving to the right and moving to the left at the same time, that is profoundly odd. And that single statement there, that this single result that we've come to right here, essentially encapsulates a whole lot of why quantum mechanics is weird. So by applying that lambda equals h over p relationship to the simplest possible example we could think of, a particle in a box, we've already discovered that whatever's going on with that particle is highly non-classical. Okay? It's described by this weird wave. Whatever it's doing is described by this weird wave. And if we try to interpret it in terms of the language of particle trajectories, like a particle like a bead on a wire like this, bouncing back and forth, we would be forced to conclude that particle is moving simultaneously to the left and to the right at the same time. And that's just freaky. And that's what Perrin was saying, and we'll get to this also. When a particle goes from here to here in free space, it exists. There's a way in which you can think about quantum mechanics in which it exists simultaneously in all possible ways, in all possible paths in getting from there to there. It's, you know, it's in this path at the same time as it's in that path, and so on and so forth. With our double slit experiment, you can imagine that the particle is not on that trajectory or that trajectory, but it's actually simultaneously exists in this weird state in which it is in both trajectories at the same time, which is highly non-classical. So there's something about quantum mechanics which is just really, really at odds with our day-to-day experience with the world. Okay? And we've discovered it already right here. in this very, very simple application of that relationship. And we'll see a lot more about that as we go along. Okay, is that totally clear? Yeah.
Yeah, it's in both trajectories. One way to think about that is when we think about it in terms of waves, how is it that we get this interference pattern? We get it because, you know, there's let's say at that point over here we had front circuit interference. We get it because waves from this slit are interfering with waves from that slit. Okay, so there's something about this, there's something from this slit and something from that slit coming together and interfering. So there's a sense in which if we want to apply this wave idea to understand the behavior of particles, because the wave passes through both slits at the same time, there's some sense in which the particle does that in some weird way, which is hard to explain, hard to understand. Okay, or another way to look at it is, suppose that the particle goes through just one slit. Okay, so we know that, our pattern, our probability pattern might look something like this. So we know that with just one slit open, the particles can hit here. And with just the other slit open, the particles can hit here. But with both slits open, they can't. Okay, so we got this pattern here. So how is it, if the particle just takes one path, in getting from there to there, either that one or that one, let's suppose that one, suppose it takes that path and getting from there to there. Like I said, how does it know that the other slit is open or not? Because if the other slit were closed, then it's allowed to hit there. If the other slit is open, it's not allowed to hit there. How would it even know whether it's open or closed? Because it's over here and the slit is over there. Does it somehow circle around? Does it hover around here and say, oh, I see that slit over there, but I'm going through this one? Like, what is it actually doing when it's, you know, it's just weird. So this double slit experiment, Richard Feynman had a famous thought experiment related to that, which maybe I'll just show you very, very quickly here, which is really cool, really amazing. So as soon as you, I mean, the double slit is a fantastic experiment because it opens up really the fundamental mystery of quantum, and there are so many different ways of looking at it. So for example, we've got, suppose we've got just our usual double slit here, like this, and here's our screen, and we say, okay, so let's ask, how is the particle can get from here to here? Well, one possibility is it can go like that. Another possibility is it can go like that. And it just turns out that you can calculate this probability pattern here by looking at the different possibilities, this possibility and that possibility, and assigning a certain amplitude, assigning a kind of a probability, a quantum probability to each one of those paths. You say, well, it's, you know, a 56% chance here, you know, 44% chance here. It's not quite like that because they're complex numbers between positive and negative. There's an amplitude. You assign a number to each one of those paths, and then you add those numbers up. Some of them are positive, some of them are negative, and then you get a total number, and then you square that number, and that number turns out to be the height of this probability curve. And so now if I go down here, say, and ask, well, how can the particle get from here to here? Well, one way is it could take that path. Another is it could take that path. And so what I do is I assign a number to that path and a number to that path, sometimes positive, sometimes negative, whatever, and I get some, and I add those two numbers up, and I get a total number, and I square it. And that turns out, lo and behold, to be the height of the probability pattern here. So anyway, as I move along this screen here and consider the two possible ways that the particle can get from there to that point on the screen, I can, by assigning numbers to those paths, probability amplitudes, I can reproduce this probability pattern exactly. Okay, so essentially it's like saying, well, so certain probabilities of the particle it is in these various certain amplitudes for these particles to exist in these various paths at the same time. Okay, anyways, that was just a bit of a precursor. The point now is Feynman said, okay, well, if that's true, then let's consider this. And this is the beauty of just thought experiments. This is fantastic. Okay, so what if we say, what if we put another barrier in here? A barrier with, let's say, I don't know, free space, like this. Okay, so now we ask, well, how can the particle get from there to there on the screen? Well, one way is it could go through that bottom slit and then that top slit and down. Or it could go through that bottom slit and through that slit and that way. Or it could go through that slit and that slit and that slit, or it could go that. You consider just all possible combinations. Okay, and so you see there are many ways in which the particle can get from there to there. And so then what Feynman says as well, for each one of those possibilities, we assign a certain probability amplitude, some complex number. And then we add up all those complex numbers and take the whole magnitude squared, and that gives the probability the particle will get from there to there on the screen. So the point is that in calculating the probability that the particle will actually hit that point on the screen, you need to consider all possible ways in which the particle can get from there to there. So that's all very fine and well. What if we add more screens? Okay, so we'll add some more here. So we'll say, and we'll put another one over here with like five slits, another one over here, another one over here, and then we look at, you know, while people go through there, so there, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a zillion ways now. We look at all the possible combinations and permutations. There's now a zillion ways to do this. You do the same calculation. You add up, you assign that complex number to all of those paths, and you add them all up, and you get and you square it, and you get the probability that the particle ends up there. Okay, so then you take would be extreme case. Well, what happens if we put in like a zillion barriers, and we drill so many holes in those barriers, okay, that there's essentially no barrier left. Okay, and so then at the end of the day, what you end up with is this picture. Well, the particle, in getting from here to here on the screen through empty free space, can do this, or it can do that, or it can go to the moon and then back. It can do virtually anything. It can go faster than the speed of light. It can do anything. Okay, so all you do is assign a number to all of those possible paths. Each one of those paths you look at, there's a certain way, there's a certain mathematical way you can do that, which is well defined. You do it, and you get a complex number for every one of those paths, and you just add them all up, and you square it, and that's the probability that the particle is going to actually hit that point on the screen as opposed to some other point. Okay. So what I'm saying is that, and this is what Perrin was saying, is that the idea of a definite particle trajectory essentially breaks down in quantum. Okay, so when we're thinking about this particle in the box, which is the simplest possible case we can imagine, the classical trajectories are, well, at any instant of time, it's either moving to the right, you know, or it's moving to the left. Those are the two trajectories. Okay, and it's just bouncing back and forth like that. Okay, that's not what's happening. Okay, it's something more like this. It exists simultaneously in a trajectory going, if you want to think in terms of trajectories, you have to go to such a bizarre extent that you need to consider essentially all possible trajectories occurring simultaneously. And that means, in this simple case, right and left occurring simultaneously, which is highly non-classical. It's just simply freaky. Yeah.
Why is there a
light? I missed the last part of that. So you're saying light instead of the particle, or using light to observe the particle?
Using light to explain
the rest. So if you want to go to the rest, you just need to like see the wave is moving. Instead of a mass moving, we're thinking about, well, actually, that's not. So all of this applies also for light, for example. So light is, so at the end of the day, all of this applies for all particles. So whether you're talking about a photon, a particle of light, or an electron, a particle of the electron field, or a gluon or a quark or whatever, all of these particles all behave the same way. They all behave according to lambda equals h over p. So there's no distinction, there's no fundamental distinction between light and particles. So I guess at the end of the day, one could say that there's not really, at a fundamental level, there aren't particles and there aren't waves. There's a third thing. There's something called a quantum particle, which obeys that kind of relationship. Yeah.
Does everything behave in a quantum mechanical way? Like, if you have a baseball, it would do the same thing. And if you have, like, the larger, bigger thing that within the even bigger scale, that is so interesting.
Yes, that's a very good question. I mean, so certainly at this very ultra microscopic level, things behave in this weird quantum way. And then the question is, well, how far does that extend? Why isn't that obvious in the day-to-day world? I mean, one of the simple answers is that for objects like people that are walking around in airplanes and trains and so on, C is extremely large. So H is extremely, H is extremely small to begin with, and P is extremely large. So this number is way super tiny for everyday objects. And so the wavelength is super, super tiny for everyday objects. And so because the wavelength is so tiny, we don't see any diffraction effects, for example. Like when I walk through that door, I don't get like diffracted and because it's just like sunlight going through a window, right? The wavelength is so small compared to the apertures through which we're walking. We just don't see that. But it is a fundamental question: Does this quantum nature, apply to the everyday world? Like how far? Like starting from the ultra microscopic. How much can we increase the size of things and still observe this behavior? Of course, it gets technically harder and harder to do, but as a matter of principle, does it exist? Or is there some point at which it kind of switches over to classical? And this is a very, very important question. So of course, experimentally, the way you try to answer that question is you do a double slit experiment. You start with electrons and you say, oh yes, 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 I see this interference pattern. And then you have bigger particles. You then do, say, an atom, an entire atom, which is a proton and an electron. You fire atoms through, and then you find that, oh, atoms also, they have this wave. The entire atom itself exhibits this wave-like behavior, and you get an interference pattern. You get diffraction
and interference. Okay, and then you crank it up in size to bigger and bigger molecules. So I think the biggest molecule now is a buckyball, so 60 carbon atoms, or is it bigger now? I think it's 60. So big, huge, lumbering molecules that are made up of 60 atoms. That's like huge. It's a huge thing, and that thing in itself, sent by itself, these buckyballs are called, sent by themselves through this apparatus, display interference. They interfere with themselves. It's as if they really are doing this kind of. There's something like this, being present in both. Slits simultaneously. Yeah.
Can we take principle of this action into consideration?
So the principle of least action does apply here in the sense that where do we get. How does classical mechanics sort of come out of this? So this is quantum, and we consider all possibilities. Okay, so let's suppose that we're in a gravitational field and we throw a baseball and the classical trajectory is this. Okay, quantum mechanically that baseball, let's just think of it as a super tiny baseball, okay, it exists simultaneously in all possible paths. Okay, and so you can recover classical mechanics from quantum mechanics with a sort of extremization principle, like you're saying. So essentially, let's see. How can I say this? The complex number associated with the actual classical path is say this number. Is that number there. and on some axis like this. Okay, and then if you consider neighboring paths to this, neighboring very, very closely neighboring the classical path, then all of those numbers will differ only very, very slightly from this classical number here. But if you go to paths that are very, very far away, those numbers are just sort of like wildly different. And so it turns out that when you're adding up these paths, these ones that are very, very different like this, there's lots of plus and lots of minus, and there's lots of general cancellation. Whereas the paths that are the sort of the bundle of paths that are very close to the classical path, you sort of go through a minimum here. Okay, and so they all have sort of the same value, and so they add up constructively. And so there's a higher probability that it's actually going to be doing something close to the classical path. I'm sorry, that's probably not super clear, but I couldn't hear it sort of fairly. Yeah?
The bounds of the bound particle in the box depending on how you're observing it, and is that by when you're looking at a particle in a tiny space, it gets really dramatic?
So I think there's two sort of questions in there. So how do we actually make a box?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah.
So one way we can make a box like that is using electric fields, like electric and magnetic fields. So electric fields can exert forces on particles. And so you just sort of make a very, very strong electric field that's in a very small region. So that you know, it's free particle here, also it enters a region with a strong electric field that just repels it back. And that's one way that you could do it. Yeah. Yeah.
Are particles assumed to be like shapeless points in space?
As far as we're concerned, yeah. So they're shapeless points in space. They're just point particles. So all of what we're talking about can be understood in the context of point particles. Yeah. Yeah.
About two things. Have they actually done the side experiments with buckyballs and bigger things? Or?
Yeah. So they've done it with buckyballs, but I know for sure. And of course, they're trying to push it for bigger.
Have they observed the same results?
Yes, exactly the same. Oh. I mean, it's harder to observe because the wavelength gets shorter, and so the whole pattern gets tighter, and so on. It's harder to observe. But to the extent that you should be able to observe it, it's exactly what you should be able to see.
And also, so there's a chance that when we do like throw a baseball or something, the path that we're seeing is actually like the baseball is actually in a whole bunch of different paths, they're just so slightly different that it looks like there's one path? Or are we actually seeing the ball in a whole bunch of different paths that are just so small that.
Well, not exactly. Because, I mean, it gets really complicated. I mean, first of all, as soon as you observe, if you take this experiment, this is a great question. So if you take this experiment and you leave both slits open, okay, you see this experiment, right? If you say and there's somehow we're led to the idea that in some weird freaky way. The particle somehow appears to exist in both slits simultaneously. And they would say, well, that's just ridiculous. Let's actually look and see whether it actually is in both slits at the same time. So you set up some detector over here, you know, that which shines light or whatever and detects which slit it goes through. Turns or if, you know, if it goes through this slit, then there's going to be sort of a transfer of momentum, because the particle originally had a momentum component in the upward direction, now has a momentum component in the downward direction. Obviously, there's going to be some transfer of momentum to this screen in the upward direction if it takes the upward path, or down if it takes the downward path. And so just by looking at the transfer of momentum to this screen, you can determine which slit it actually went through. It turns out that no matter how clever you are, no matter how you come up with some clever experimental way of determining which slit it's gone through, as soon as the resolution of your apparatus is sufficient to actually determine, to actually pin down which slit it's actually going through, then you find that, oh, indeed it does go only through one slit or the other. Okay, but then your interference pattern at the same time is totally washed out. Then you just see that. Okay, so basically when you're not looking, you get this interference pattern. When you're actually looking, oh, which slit is that actually going through, then it washes out the interference pattern. And which isn't surprising, it's not like a big history. It's just that because you're just doing a different experiment. Right? The original experiment had it was just bare, just the empty slits here. The new experiment you're doing has a source of photons here, maybe looking at the particles, or it has some rollers here. It's got some other stuff. And so the electron exists in a different world. And so the results are different. Like, it's not really that surprising. But the point is that if you try to nail down which slit it's going through, it'll just show you the classical results. So yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know much about the properties of the experiments, but I'm very trying to make this feel like during
the slit experiment. So for example, using photons in the slit experiment and you're trying to determine if photons are going faster or slower than the speed of light? I think that any measurement, so this idea of going faster than slower than applies to faster or slower than the speed of light applies to virtual particles. So the particles that it's like states that you can't actually observe. Okay, so if you actually observe it, you try to observe it, you will find that it's going to speed of light, say a photon. Okay, but in going, from say here to there, it exists in these multiple different paths, then if you're not actually trying to observe it, then just to explain how the photon gets from here to here, you have to consider all possible paths, including ones where it goes faster than it's going in the speed of light. But if you actually observe it, you'll sort of nail it down and you will always see it going to speed of light.
Set a time when the particle starts from the beginning point, and when it then detected, you can just measure.
Yeah.
Isn't that possible?
Yeah. And then if we do that, if we do that, then we'll always find the speed of light. See. It doesn't change the trajectory in the other trajectory. I mean all that's happening is, let's take one particular example. And let's suppose that what we've got here is a little microscope, okay, which is looking at these two. So we're like up close to the slits, we have in this microscope and we're looking. And so we're trying to see the electron, which slit it goes through. Well, in order to see the electron, we have to shine light. Light is made up of photons, particles. And so let's see. Suppose that the photon comes, the photon will either come back from the electron here or it'll travel further and come back from the electron here. And so those are sort of the two possibilities. But the point is that if we actually see the electron, that means that a photon has hit the electron and bounced off. Well, as soon as that happens, here's the photon coming in. And there's the electron, minding its own business, going this way. All of a sudden, the photon hits it and deflects the electron that way, and the photon comes scattering off that way into our eye, into our microscope. And so, just the very act of looking at the electron has disturbed the electron, and it disturbs it in sort of a random way. And so instead of having this nice, you get an interference pattern by there being a strict sort of phase relationship between that particle and that particle, or that path and that path. If you now hit the electron and disturb it sort of randomly like this, then you introduce a randomness to its subsequent motion, and it just washes over the interference pattern.
What I think you're saying is that even if you're not like shining a photon down, you find other ways to observe it, that's the interference pattern?
Yeah, even if you use other ways,
it will always disturb the particle.
It will always disturb the particle in some way. Yeah, there will always be a way. And ultimately, that's because this is a fundamental fact about the universe. So like I said, all particles, whether they're photons or electrons or whatever, all fundamental particles obey this relationship. So anything that you try to do, if you try to observe something, observing something means, like with a microscope, you're using light. Okay, that involves wavelength. Well, as I said before, the what you can observe with a microscope has a certain resolving power. And what you can observe with that microscope, you can't observe anything smaller than the wavelength of the light that you're using. Okay, so basically, the more closely you want to pin something down, the more closely you want to observe something. Is it going through backslit or backslit? These slits are very close together. The more closely you try to pin something down and see it, the smaller the wavelength you have to use for the particle. Smaller wavelength corresponds to larger momentum. You have to use a larger momentum photon or a larger momentum electron if you're talking about an electron microscope or whatever. Whatever microscope you're using, to get smaller wavelength and hence higher resolution, you need to use larger momentum particles. They just carry a lot more oomph. So when you actually do see that thing, there's been a lot more of an interaction, like a really high momentum particle slamming into the particle that you're interested in and bouncing off. And bouncing off in sort of random direction. And so there's a random amount of momentum that's imparted to the object that you're looking at. So you disturb that particle randomly, but with larger and larger momentum, so more and more. So the more you try to nail it down, the more you disturb it, what you're actually observing. And that's fundamental because all particles, whether you're talking photons, electrons, or whatever, all obey this relationship. You can't get around it. Anything that you build, whether it's a microscope or whether it's little rollers here or to measure momentum change or whatever, anything you build fundamentally obeys that. And that's it. And that's so, we are limited. In anything that we build is made out of stuff in the universe, and all that stuff obeys that. So there's no way to sort of escape it. Yeah.
I just could ask, in the single slit experiments, the double slit experiments, the reason to ask like the wave shape is because it appears in the crust and like intersect each other, right?
Yeah.
So theoretically, shouldn't the waves be highest in the middle and then sort of dilute as it goes further?
Why not as it goes further?
Because like the biggest waves, the maximum are at the middle where they first interfere, and then so shouldn't it be like highest in the middle and then sort of, because how can you have like maximum up here, right?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So what you're saying is so you're pointing out a just sort of an it's just a physical fact about this experiment. Okay, so here's the double slit experiment, and so the interference pattern I drew looked like this.
Yeah.
Well, so that's not entirely correct. So what you're pointing out is this central maximum should be the brightest, should be the tallest, and that these maxima should go down because. What's the exact reason? Is it because the distances are greater now, and waves in general decay?
No, I was just thinking the reason it has a bright spot there is because I think it's the crests, or that's it.
Yeah,
the
so a crest from here and a crest from here, if they leave at the same time, they will hit that point at the same time, and they will add to get the double crest.
Yeah, and the dark spots are because of the trope, right?
Yeah, so a dark spot here is because, say, when a wave, like the things which reach here at the same time might be a wave crest from here and a wave trough. So look at the wave crest leaves here at the same time as a wave trough. Okay, then these guys might, What I want to say is waves and crests are leaving from here. They're traveling along here.
And just because of the difference in distance, it might so happen that when a wave from this one reaches here, that's the time that a trough from this one reaches here, and you get these types of interference. Right. Why? Oh, you're worried about this one? Oh, way up here? But why? Why can't I go as far up as I want? Why can't I go up to the moon? Okay, let's look at that point over here. So there's a path difference between, if I take this path, it's shorter. If I take that path, it's longer. What's the path difference? Well, it's this amount here. What if this is, all we need is that this to be an integer number of wavelengths. One wavelength, or two wavelengths, or three wavelengths. If it's an integer number of wavelengths, then when a crest is here, a crest is here at the same time. And then two, because that the distance from there to there is distance from there to there is the same as from there, crest here means that they meet as a double crest, crest with crest. And so I can go as high up as I want. So now my triangle is way up like that. And so now it's that distance. Yeah, so eventually, that's right. I mean, eventually this thing tips over all the way, and so you've got this situation, and the maximum difference in path length is the distance between the flips. And at a certain point, yeah, you're not going to be able to fit any more full wavelengths in there. So maybe you get five. You get five of these, and then eventually it just goes down. But it, yeah, so, yeah, I see, okay, yeah. Well, they do drop off a little bit because of the distance. So waves in general, when they're spreading out, depending on whether you're talking two-dimensional waves or three-dimensional waves, they, in general, they decay in amplitude. And so because this, in general, in this direction, it's shorter, in this direction, it's longer, the waves will have decayed more, and so the actual pattern is not exactly like this. It's exactly like this, except these peaks are not quite as high. They kind of start to go down. But the location of the peaks, which is really what we care about, that's the same. Yeah. So this will go down. So if you look at the experimental result, for example, the one we had on the video there. So yeah, it was brightest, those fringes were brightest in the center, and then it'll go down. So the probability will go down, that it will go, you know, way out there. Yeah. 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 Okay, so it's okay. Yeah. So what is the evidence? Well, it's indirect in that to understand. So here's a general statement. In order to understand the results of an experimental you set things up or whatever, and you get some result. In order to understand that, in order to put a theoretical picture in our mind of what's actually happening, the pictures that we put in our mind are of the type that say. The particle is doing all kinds of things, including going faster than the speed of light and getting from there to there. When we do that, then we get the right answer. When we ignore those ones going faster than the speed of light, we don't get the right answer. Like according to our whole general framework, theoretical physics kind of framework for understanding the world around us, those things are included in when we make predictions about experiments. Is what I'm saying, yeah, generally, yeah.